5 years I've been here. Nothing told me to ask for a loan, a small loan. She told me that I was not economically viable. And I thanked her for 7 years. 7 years. Excuse me, sir. Excuse me. How'd your loan work out? Did they give you a loan? He must be economically viable. There's a man with a smile on his face. He looks like a happy customer. That's what an economically viable person looks like.
Good morning, Winter Park.
Good morning.
Well, you have reached Punkonomics, the show that pretty much touches on every taboo that the media talks about and don't want to talk about. And
but we're working on it.
Exactly. And my name is Jesse Velez, and host Benny Balak today will be talking about the class warfares, since everybody decided to keep quiet, meaning the media, it's not talking about it anymore. They're trying to reach a kumbaya type scenario. We decided that we're going to touch on these things that are relevant to what's going on to the middle class and everybody else that works for a living. Anyway, moving right along, Dr. Balak, let's show right away. Class warfare, back in history, of course, it was class warfare, but today's class warfare is completely different. I mean, you have the media and several other things that are quite obvious that actually are not really helping because they're keeping the status quo. What is your opinion on that? Do you think that things are not going to change at all? And what will it take to bring some kind of economic change that's going to not really satisfy everybody, because that's almost impossible, but get to a level where people are going to say, okay, there is some kind of hope out there if I choose to go to school, have a family, and whatnot.
Whoa. I should have had another coffee. What a question.
Yeah, well, I had my Cheerios this morning.
I don't actually, literally don't have a piece of paper in that example.
And actually, before you start, you know, I know I shouldn't do this, but we want to give a big shout out to all your Republicans out there, particularly the extreme right wingers.
The depressed ones?
Yes, we really want you to feel good about yourselves. And, you know, if you have any kind of psychological problems, please, by all means, there's tons of psychologists out there. Like Bill Maher said, there's plenty of psychologists out there for everybody to go and get some help.
Since Jesse kind of went all partisan on us, I feel maybe I'll take a little detour now, just because of my addled brain at this time of the day. It's been a long week. So you, Jesse, got to make sure that I answer your question, because there's a whole bunch of stuff and I need to, well, anyway, you know. But first, you know what? If you're really disappointed with the results, don't be. I'll tell you why. Because your chances of winning 26 big time just 2016 just went up, you know, because the economy is not going to get significantly better. If Obama's lucky, there'll be a little bit of bump. Maybe he'll manage to do something better. But it's not going to be a solution to our problems. It's just not. It's not personal. The system is not geared, not tooled for it. The real people in power, if you'll allow me to get all conspiracy theory, which I look more and more at right-wing conspiracy theory recently. Really, I find affinity. I disagree. I talk about it. You know, that's great. But anyway, in some sense, if Romney had gotten into power, I will admit that I think he was worse in terms of economics. Therefore, I think the economy would have tanked even faster for most Americans under Romney. And in some sense, now you've got Obama still, and you can continue blaming him, like, with all these silly blaming,
exactly,
as if he's some kind of, you know, third world, big justice socialist, which is just, excuse me.
Right.
Oh, what's a polite way to say that? Silly? He's a Reagan conservative, by the way, if you want to know. I mean, what label would apply to actually what Obama does, all right? Not what he promises or what people say about him. So I'm saying, cheer up. In fact, you're really much better off in 2016 if you're a conservative, because there'll be much to blame. I don't think a miracle will happen under Obama. I'm pretty willing to make a bet, frankly, you know. And if I lose, all the better for America and for the world. I'll be happy to lose, happy to be proven wrong. I'm usually happy to be proven wrong because I'm usually predicting bad things. Back to your question. First of all, you know, you said that class war is different today than before. That allows me to use one of my favorite quotes, and I'll give actually credit to somebody who's inspiring me a little bit for this show, which I think is a great guy. Check him out. It's Dan Carlin. He does history podcast, and he does a common sense podcast, you know, Dan Carlin with a C. I think our Punkonomics likes him on Facebook. That's another way to find it. But he does a really good job at kind of bipartisan equal opportunity hatred. So I'm inspired by him in a large sense. And that would be Mark Twain, probably the person who generates most useful quotes on the planet in history. And it would be that history does not repeat itself, but it often rhymes. Right, so yeah,
yes, it's not excellent
the same.
Quote.
Yeah, isn't it?
Yes,
it's not the same, but hey, you can actually learn something from the comparison, so long as you don't too naively say, "Oh, it's exactly the same." No, it's never exactly the same. But are there elements that are similar? In most things, they are, because history kind of builds upon itself. We don't kind of pop into existence in a vacuum, right?
Right, right.
Okay, so class war. I mean, the term is usually associated with the left wing because certainly early, especially Karl Marx, you know, the father of socialism, wrote about it. But let me say right away that some of the best, most insightful right-wing conservatives from America originally, one of my favorite economists, actually, which would be Buchanan, James Buchanan, Nobel
Not
laureate, 76,
no relation
George
to Pat,
Mason.
Right?
Nope, no relation. He actually said to say, wait a minute, I mean, it's kind of obvious that different groups from different perspectives, different economic contexts have different interests, different environments, different ways of, certainly different economic interests. So he started articulating economic interest groups. Some of you might be shocked that the traditional economics taught in 99.9% of programs, you know, certainly in the undergraduate level, the neoclassical, that horrible, big, thick, overpriced book that some of you have had the misfortune of owning with the title Economics on the topic,
right.
That thing, which is, by the way, about 80% wrong, provably, both like looking at data, looking at history, even mathematically. Huh? So I know it sounds like a strong statement. How come? Well, maybe another topic maybe will follow. But all of these neoclassical, traditional mainstream economists assume government to be, and I quote, this is a technical term, a benevolent dictator. So they have no interest, they have no conflicts, they're just some kind of this aggregation of wise men who have the best, you know, who are attempting with the best of their efforts to help us all, to be the best possible ruler, etc., etc. Okay. Need I say anything about that? So Buchanan, kind of following, reading the socialist, says, wait a minute, why only socialists talk about people having different interests? That if you are in the top 1%, to use the, you know, the popular way of saying it today, you have very different interests in the economy. Now, if you're in the top 1%, you don't care about public education. Your kids probably aren't, unless you live in Rhode Island or somewhere, you know,
right,
where the
right.
public education is that good, you know. Vermont, you know, things like that.
Well, you can tell by the way they tried to cut back on the money, the funding, and everything else.
Right? I mean, now, possibly you might be very wealthy and think about the poor all day and want, I mean, you know, absolutely, you know. Sadly, those are exceptions. Most people kind of not being selfish bastards, really. That's That's all right. Simply, it's very difficult to put yourself in other people's shoes. Well, sincerely, you know, with the best intentions. People, you know, I've heard a lot of Republicans actually worry that maybe the Romney was a mistake because he was so, I mean, even Republicans thought he was some kind of, you know, this live from somebody coming from Versailles, you know, this kind of aristocrat that never even set foot on the street.
Actually, he came from the planet Kolob, so they say, right?
Yeah, I'm actually judiciously using Versailles because, you know, I mean, we do have a distribution of income today resembling France before the revolution, by the way. And as a historian and as a francophone, in other words, speak French, my wife is. I read some of the stuff today I get with arguments with people, you know, it sounds just like translated into French and, you know, put a white wig on and it sounds exactly the same. I just hope it, well, we find a better solution, perhaps a more amicable solution than they did, shall I say. But anyway, right? So James Buchanan, these interest group considerations, wonderful work, looking at government opening up. Wait a minute. Anti-government, by the way. Shout out to my Republican friend, right? Or general conservative friends. In the sense that, you know, let's look at government. They also need good incentives, just like business. If they don't have good incentives, then they will not do a good job in our market system.
Sure.
So government needs to be studied. The black box, as it were, of this, oh, you know, benevolent dictator needs to be opened up and see how could we... That also opens up to improving government. So I really, really like it from that perspective. Because otherwise we get back to this kind of, you know, electoral and general BS that we have when we talk about the economy, whether, oh, do you like government or do you like business? You know, is government the problem or is private, very powerful private corporations the problem? And of course, it's a silly question. The problem, following Adam Smith, again, not Karl Marx here, the problem is government in bed with
business,
large corporations.
Right, right.
You know? So that's what's one of the main reasons. And I've been all like gung-ho right-wing all morning. I mean...
Well, you know, this is what I don't get. I mean,
must be the power drink.
You have you have all these disasters happening recently. You know, the 9/11s, the hurricanes, not the recent... storm that we had up in New Jersey. And, you know, the first thing that people start screaming for is government help.
Yeah.
And it seems to me that if you don't have government, when these things happen, what are you going to do?
Absolutely, absolutely. Again, wonderful. I mean, you know, just hitting on all these, like, big issues. Yeah, you know, it's not about big government or small government. That's very boyish and childish.
Yeah, right,
you
exactly.
You get the joke, you know. Yeah, you know, you're like big government, small government. No, it's about good government. Now, some of us might think that let us err on the side of minimalist government, the least necessary, but this notion that we could live without. When you have no government, you're ruled by violent, crazed warlords.
Right.
No exceptions. Look around, you know? You need some kind of government whenever you have two people just to figure out how to share the coconuts on the island.
Sure. Somalia, you know, some of those places.
Yeah, when you have no government, it's not pretty. Of course, our government has, in America and in many other places in the world, there's a major crisis in government. The government is not functioning well. I mean, again, that would be... You know, what I have the conservative fallacy is to think that we can manage without government, you know, but the liberal fallacy is to think that the government we have would perform its role.
Right, right, right.
So the focus again is on functioning government, and the core, I mean, a lot of people talk, and we should talk, and it is the source of all evil, if you will, to some extent, is campaign financing.
Exactly.
It's terrible. But that sits on top, it's on purpose. I mean, there's a reason why billionaires slowly but surely have changed the rules so that they own the government, you know? Here's your class war. I look at the numbers, right? And I see that the wealth and the income dramatically moved upwards. From the poor, well, they don't have much, so not much moving, right? The middle class of America, the backbone of America, the backbone of the market system since the 18th century. Necessary. A big, powerful middle class. You know, when you had a lot of billionaires and the rest of us, that was before the market system. That was before capitalism. That's where we're going.
Right.
You know, so when we gutted the middle class, there's capitalism or market system, whatever you prefer the name, cannot even function theoretically. It doesn't work. You can't just impose a system that doesn't fit. Just like if they came up with market system in the Middle Ages, people would look at them funny. Well, we're getting there again. You
right.
know, you have to have these urban people, you have to have a lot of middle class people, upward mobility, all of those things that we've lost. And then we have very powerful elites, like the nobles of the olden times, you know, who tell us that, oh, they'll take good care of us. Well, they've been doing that for thousands of years.
You know, and it seems,
lying about it, naturally.
It seems like most politicians, and this is right and left, it seems like they believe they're monarchy or some kind of royalty, that they're different from the average citizen.
They do. I mean, I'm biased here. You know, I mean, I know your background is psych, and you know, maybe you can enter into that, but I have a bias as an economist. So I'm saying, like, nah, I mean, sure, individual feelings and elements like that are important, and culture is important, and religion is important, everything's important. But those are kind of on top of the fundamental economic relations in society. That's kind of pretty much the foundations. So, yeah, I mean, you know, scholarship actually very, very clearly studies from multiple perspectives and disciplines the thing that every American knows. Like I said, again, I don't want to just point at Romney necessarily. It's just that, you know, Republicans have been raising it, you know, this disconnect. You know, if you live in the top 0.001%, you know, you don't even know how it feels to be put in first class in a commercial airline, you know?
Right.
I mean, you don't know how to clean yourself because you have a staff of servants, you know?
Yeah, I know, and I come from that background.
No joke, you know? And you live among people who are just like you, so you don't get a chance to see other people who face different interests. You eventually have a hard time. You have to go to school, and, you know, and we have a lot of rich kids in Rawlins, you know, and many of them, you can literally see them kind of open their mind. They don't change their ideologies at all, usually.
Sure.
But they open their mind. They see, wait a minute, you know, the world is not my country club. There's other things out there.
Exactly.
And it's not even very far. You don't have to go out in the third world. It's just across the street.
You know, and you're right about that. When I talk to my colleagues in class, and, you know, of course, it's a mix. Economics and at Hall, you pretty much have a
and also day and night
day
student.
And night student.
Yeah. I love those because I think it adds. I mean,
yes.
Diversity actually is not an ideology; it's scientific.
Yeah, you know, when I look into their eyes and we discuss politics, and you know, we try to present both views on an intellectual level. You know, everybody knows that it's not personal. You start seeing their eyes light up. It's kind of like, oh my God, you know, I didn't even know that this was happening or this actually exists, or that, you know, we're actually in a system that only caters to one part of the population. And you can tell they mean well and they want to go out and game back, you know, busters and change the world. But you and I have been through that before. It seems like the youth has a pattern of not really being rebellious, but to change things. And then when they get to the reality, the economics, you know, having to feed your family and all that, then it's almost like they shift, or they just kind of get so entrenched in trying to survive that they forget what's going on in the world. And one of the things that we were talking about before the show is the fact that personally, as a single person, you know, I feel that single people here in the U.S., and I'm sure a lot of you out there will agree with me, that we are paying way too many taxes. And I'm not saying that we shouldn't pay taxes. What I'm saying is that we should be able to get at least some kind of...
What's married people, too?
Well, yes. Let me clarify what I'm trying to say here.
17%?
What I'm trying to say is that when you're single, you don't have support of a family or your parents or whatever else, and you're out there, the services that you're getting are minimum, if not none. So therefore, you know, if people want to claim that, yeah, okay, we have the lowest taxes, well, that's not really true. Because when you go to an emergency room because you don't have health care, that's a lot of money. I mean, I don't...
Or even if you have health care.
Right, or even if you have health care, which it seems to me that, and you can correct me on this, if we didn't have health care, would we have a bigger problem with the deficit? Because obviously we have a law that says we can't turn people away from the emergency rooms. So who's going to pay for that bill?
There's a world of problem. I mean, healthcare is a case study of dysfunctionality in the country. I mean, it's insane. But even before taking it one step back, there's a tremendous amount of very confusing information. And that also links to, and you know, I have an interest in media and in propaganda that we don't even know what's going on. So, you know, we discussed how Americans actually perceive the to go back to your class kind of situation, they perceive the situation of distribution of income and wealth completely unrealistic than what it really is. In other words, Americans think America is way more egalitarian than it actually is, way less divided economically than it actually is. And then you ask Americans, I think I actually put it also on the Facebook group, that lovely graphic that sums this up, but it's been a lot of studies on this. Then you ask them, so okay, reality, like pre-capitalist, pre-market system, like, or Brazil in recent years used to be the poster child for income maldistribution,
what right,
we call
right.
it, you know, when its income is very concentrated on the top, etc. Very bad situation. Americans think that it, you know, that we're about like France. And when asked why, and France is unequal, increasingly so. Don't forget, you know, all the other countries are copying America still, for better and for worse.
Of course, exactly. Even the bad habits.
I used to tick off a lot of French people back in the 80s when I lived there by saying, well, if you've got a problem with American way of doing things, why do you copy them all the time? And I used to really tick off.
Right, right.
And I like to tick off people. but it makes you think, you know, any kind of kick on the side of the head. You know, I give myself one every morning. Or try. But anyway, and then I ask Americans, what kind of, how would you share the pie of American wealth if it was up to you? And including Republicans here, you know, it's actually the divide is shockingly small between those recognizing themselves as liberals and those recognizing themselves as conservative. Well, Americans, on the average, say we want an income distribution.
Right.
Like Sweden in the 70s, about as socialist as a capitalist system can get. Sweden is not what it used to be either. Not at all. Right? So, funny, right? What Americans actually advocate, and a big part of getting screwed.
Yeah.
my tentative use of that language. I mean, can I say that? But it's difficult to speak cleanly, isn't it? When you're angry, we'll get to that maybe too. So Americans are decent people. They know what they need. They actually have all that. They recognize the main problems. The issue is that nobody cares. Nobody's trying to solve the problem.
I also think part of that too is that we've been indoctrinated to thinking group type mentalities. And for people to stand out and say, "Okay, guys, we know what the problem is. Let's start doing something about it."
Yeah.
You're perceived as a rebel rouser or somebody who's going against the grain when indeed you're following the philosophy or the well intentions of the group.
As a foreigner, I always thought that's the American way, you know, to raise some hell.
Right, you know, and that's what really gets me because I lived in Puerto Rico for a while, and you know, coming back to the States, and like you, living in Puerto Rico, you know, some of the independent movement, which I kind of happen to favor too as well. But I am an American. My allegiance is to America. And a lot of people don't understand that. But what I found is that I would say the same thing. Is that if you have a problem with America, you know, then why is it that you wear their jeans? Why is it that you watch their programs? You know,
and now I can enact like the same kind of economic policies too. I mean, they talk, you know.
Exactly.
But then they're like Obama, by the way.
Right.
You talk the talk of justice and change, and then you do the same old, same old.
Right. And you know, and then when I came back, I'm going like, oh, great. You know, I'm back in my country where I can speak out and say whatever I want and, you know, get things done and whatever. And you know, maybe things changed in the 5 or 8 years that I was in Puerto Rico. But when I came back, what I ran into was this mentality that you're either completely blind and follow the group, or you're sort of an outsider. And if you're an outsider, you better have something to back it up and make sure that it works. Otherwise, you're out. And that's a disappointment that I think that most people, foreigners or immigrants or whatever you want to call them, run into. It's kind of like, oh, okay. And then from a psychological view, they go like, well, okay, then I'm going to entrench myself and become a little bit more conservative Republican. That's what I find is that a lot of people that come from different countries wind up following the Republican doctrine because it seems like it's more cohesive versus a whole bunch of ideas being pulled from each direction, like, you know, most liberals. And of course, then they wind up migrating back to the original.
Well, not
being
Latinos.
Liberal.
I mean, you know, one of the standard, right? I mean, but I've heard about that actually on the left for a long time. People have been, you know, waiting on Latino immigration to to help Americans, you know, because overall much more politically enlightened, aware at least of the diverse options in politics, so that you actually have, and mostly progressive, I kind of help, because it gives them points, you know, as opposed to much of the Republican failure was alienating Latino voters. In some ways, I mean, if I understand correctly, and I'm no expert, I'm not even going there, but even more than women, I mean, I thought actually, for me, the reason that might have probably made me go and vote not for third party, given that Florida being a swing state, maybe, I'm not sure, I probably wouldn't have been able to vote either of the main parties,
couldn't
physically. But I would seriously contemplate it on women's issue, as we talked last week about Republicans going, you know, on that one. But actually, you know, Latinos really are the ones, especially in the long run. I know Republicans are shrill about the insanity of alienating Latinos who are.
You know what? I was so shocked at the stats on the amount of Latinos. Actually, Florida, 62% of the Latinos, at least in Miami-Dade County, went for Obama. Now,
and that's again all the relatively very conservative Cubans.
And this is what really shocks me is that for the longest time, I mean, for the last 20 something years, it seems like I shouldn't say hate, but the animosity towards Kennedy was a fuel for the Cuban community just to vote Republican.
Yeah.
And now, all of a sudden, they're showing 62%
of
the Latinos.
And terrorism, by the way. I shouldn't say that. It's probably dangerous. But in all honesty, the Cubans in America, in Miami, for a long time already have been way mellow, realizing the, you know, they don't like Castro, perfectly right. A lot of people don't. They have very good reasons not to, and others have very good reason to like him, whatever. But this whole, like, monolithic view of the you know, like bloodthirsty Cubans is not true. It's misrepresented by a few very loud, very powerful people.
Yes,
you know?
Correctly.
So, in all honesty, around here in Florida, I shouldn't say more because.
But I was very surprised to see that change, and I think it's probably a generational thing.
Yeah.
You know, where the kids have gone like, well, wait a minute, my Democrat friends. Don't have a job, or they're, you know, doing this, or they have these ideas that sound kind of good, versus before when I was growing up, my parents, working class, were Democrats, and you know, most of the family, except maybe for the ones that became rich, would always vote Democrat because they voted according to their economic situation, and now what I'm seeing is that people are actually thinking about their choices. And what's really good. I mean, of course, you know, saying that sometimes we have to take painful remedies, you know, which means that everybody needs to pull their share here in the States. We want the U.S. to become what it used to be. You know, and
it's hard to go back in history, but there's still a good future if we deal with it. But we're certainly not on the path. But I want to, I mean, again, that's something that I would challenge any person, including a you know professional economist, to tell me how the hell can a capitalist system function with a distribution of income, a feudal distribution of income. I mean, mechanics, if you want to talk at any level. It has a lot of effects. I mean, to go back to and isolation, you know, it's one of the problems, actually, that we teach. And that gets also to why the kids are, and I think you're absolutely right, and I've seen some writing about it, and I observed it myself in the classroom. The kids are submissive.
Mm-hmm.
Broken down.
Right.
Remind me, you know, after boot camp kind of, you know, situation, dazed and confused, you know, and respectful of authority and just wishing they'd leave it alone.
Right.
We do it on purpose. Again, you know, I mean, it's always an issue of on purpose sometimes sounds like, and I told you I like my conspiracy theorists, you know, Alex Jones and Jesse Ventura and all that. Love those guys. They always get a chunk of it wrong, but also a chunk of it right. So I appreciate that. And they're just shouting against establishment, which is always to be applauded. But you see, we're there is a degree to which you can say, oh, there's a conspiracy. A bunch of billionaires are plotting to mess with the minds of our kids so that they become like, you know, drones that don't question authority and do what they're told. No. A class of people, not all of them, right? Look, you know, a Republican like Bill Gates, you know, he's turned pragmatic on a lot of things, actually.
Sure.
Wants to solve our problems, you know, and find himself aligned in many ways with what today in our crazy world is considered left-wing, which is actually how to run capitalism, really.
Right.
So the anti-capitalists are those who are screaming, I'm a capitalist, the most. The ones damaging America are the ones with the most biggest flags on their houses and on their suit labels. And it's very difficult to perceive that because they own the media. In the 90s, they took it over. Now they're attacking schools, by the way.
Sure.
Heavily. Mm-hmm. Heavily. They're buying them every year by the bucket load and for cheap. Schools are almost as cheap as politicians. Which are the cheapest thing on earth, really. It's
shocking
to think how people who can throw around billions can buy a single senator for, like, you know, 20 grand. You got them for a few years. It's very cheap, actually. Hence the return to lobbying. The big businesses of America no longer, it doesn't make sense anymore to innovate, to get better workers, to retrain, to invest in new technology. What kind of rate of return on investment can you get for that? Historically, I mean, in the biggest booms, it's a few tens of percent rate of return on your investment for good capitalism, if you will. Recently, we've measured that the rate of return on lobbying is 22,000. It's an order of magnitude, a couple of zeros above anything ever recorded in history. So you buy a politician, you know, you buy a couple of congressmen, you spread... I actually have the numbers, I think, roughly for $500,000, Koch Industries, pretty famous, kind of the left-wing, scared of them, and I think the right-wing should too, and because the Tea Party, you know, came out of a good feeling, you know, a good gut instinct that you're being messed with. And then the Koch brothers pretty much co-opted it effectively.
Exactly.
And so when I always like to say that a real Tea Party, I mean really people who are conservatives, who are angry and have every reason to be, or the ones who are totally puppets in the hands of the very same people who they are angry about, talk about how confusing things are. Anyway, for about $500,000 they got a license to pollute freely, you know, at our cost of billions. From our pockets to their pockets.
And that's what people don't understand is that that money actually comes from our pockets, not from their pockets.
No.
I mean, you know, right now, there's supposed to be a
they're the takers. They're the ones who don't pay and take everything. They're the ones who smooch on the government, who use the government to siphon off tax money. Not the poor. The poor get very little. Billionaires get millions, and they can just say this in a straight face. I mean, remember Romney with his famous 47%? I mean, never mind what he believes, I frankly don't care. That's what you have to tell our leaders, you know?
Right.
For them to feel good. That's what they feel about us. Remember the famous Marie Antoinette, you know? And they said the peasants are starving, they have no bread. She said, well, if they have no bread, let them eat cake. She actually didn't. It was left-wing propaganda. But the point was, this same attitude has materialized today. They steal. They have the hand in the government pocket. They are taking the tax. They are doing the deficit. 100%. Not poor, not food stamps. Am I getting angry? Hell yeah, actually. Yeah.
Well, actually, I hear something to laugh about. You know, the disaster that the Republicans incurred this week. Money-wise, there's actually a couple of jokes, and I'm sure some of the left-wingers put it out there, but apparently Carver is looking for a new country to go to and become a citizen because it was such a big fiasco that all these multi-billionaires that invested so much money in his campaign are really upset at him.
Carl, it's not a lot of money. In all honesty, you guys own government, Democrats and Republicans, you know, that's definitely, I'm very comfortable in my equal opportunity hate. You know, Republicans have been a little bit better at it recently, or they really shifted away, you know. They were supporting Obama in 2008, and then kind of the rulers, the 20,000 people that sit pretty much on all the board of directors of the major companies. People talk about small business. What is it now? Less than 3%, you know, of the actual economic power. Not the employment, actually. It's true that they rip more. They do more things, but they're worthless. They don't run anything. There's no small businesses. It's giant multinational corporations, foreign investments, by the way. One of the things that America didn't realize, when you open your politics to money, foreigners get in too.
Right, exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
You're open for sale to the higher bidder. And increasingly, the higher bidders might not even be from here.
You know, and as far as jobs, I mean, it's something that our audience out there might want to look at. It's just really odd. Well, I shouldn't say odd. I kind of expected it. But before the actual elections, I mean, everybody was complaining about no jobs, you know, the rate of jobs and whatnot. And, of course, there was this speculation. And, of course, it is true that a lot of these companies are sitting on a big chunk of money, and they were basically not doing anything with it, which means that...
Oh, they are. They're investing it, but not in America.
Right, exactly.
Because it's a bad investment.
Right after the election, I'm just opening up the newspaper and driving over here. I see this big sign, Toyota is hiring. And it's like, well, you know, I've never seen Toyota actually put in a big billboard, Toyota is hiring. So, I mean, if these are things to come, I'd like to say to the audience out there, just be aware of what politicians say at all times, because this thing about the jobs not coming back or they left and all that, it's just subject to their own politics. They use that to turn everybody against each other while they're lining their pockets full of money. But anyway... we have a special treat.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, we're actually going to play it. This is actually, well, you go ahead and introduce the song.
Well, I used to have, I have a diverse background, shall we say. And at some point in my life, I was living in Israel. And I was kind of a little rock star in the 80s. I'll put some material. So we had a moderate success, actually, in the good old days then. We're still played today over there as a golden oldies and such. Makes you feel kind of old. But, and anyway, a couple of years ago, we kind of got together, three of us at least, the guitarist, the bassist, and me, and decided to kind of mess with it, have fun, and record it kind of over the internet. Now the technology is available, so we send each other files and sing as I used to, and Shachar plays the guitar and actually mixes too. He lives in Washington State now, you know, and they are still back in Israel. He writes most of the material, very talented guy. And anyway, so we made a song, and it's about this anger, you know, and it's we did it in the days of the early Tea Party and Occupy movement, and it was kind of you know, how as an artist you go into the perspective of somebody who's angry. And we kind of, there we go. And it's free. And
and what's the name of the band?
We kept our old name, Poplex.
Poplex.
From the early 80s we started, really. I mean, first we had some kind of crazy punk names from the real early 80s. And Poplex was when we decided to go a little bit more commercial, new wave, and get out of the bat caves and maybe get a contract. And we did, you know, it's fun, video clips, and, you know.
Cool. Well, here it goes. The name of the song is Kill 'Em All. How appropriate.
Hey, I'm not advocating. It's art.
Exactly.
Rage. Go and kill them. can run, you can call the police. You can hide, you can hold up the white flag of peace. You can scream out for help from your private militia. It's too late, the mad dogs, we are already with you. You can crawl on your knees to the basement and hide. You can cry, make some calls, offer deals on the side. Take a pick or a shovel, get ready to dig. It's the day of the dogs, it's the night of the pigs. To kill them all, when they're not too big. To kill them all, in the day of the pigs. To kill them all, before they're too big. To kill them all, to kill them all. To kill them all, before they're too big. To kill them all, in the day of the pigs. To kill them all, before they're too big. To kill them all.
Welcome back, folks. You're listening to WPRK 91.5, Winter Park. And this is Punkonomics. And You listen to Dr. Balak's song, Kill 'Em All. And after that, we play a little Talking Heads, Life During the Wall Time.
One of the best songs ever by one of the best bands ever.
That's right. I heard a song by David Byrne. It's not Talking Heads anymore.
Right.
But one of his new songs, I can't remember the name of it, but it involves, you know, he's always bringing in a lot of ethno-cultural sounds and all that. And yeah, it was awesome. But anyway, let's go back to our conversation here.
Yeah, right. All right, so, I mean, yeah, starting with a song, really, I suppose, right? He's a very frustrated guy there, you know? Only one beep necessary, but there was certainly a lot of hate, right? I mean, if you follow the words, and if not, I'll put a link on our Facebook group, and I actually posted on my YouTube channel, I posted all the lyrics, so you can see. Incidentally, it was originally written in Hebrew by Eyal, who wrote the music, and I translated it with significant help by my two kids, who are probably still asleep, because I'm homeschooling them now in my spare time, me and my wife, which is kind of insane, but has to be done, so they don't have to wake up in the regular, I hope they're awake already. That's something, though, to lead us to the kids.
I wanted to ask you, how does that work out, the homeschooling? I mean, as far as, like, when they reach to a point where, you know, they're going to college, is that something
it's
that...
It's tricky. I mean, and maybe we could reserve, to some extent, have a whole show on the education system, because talk about a massive crisis. There's one. And not being solved at all. And all those, just throw it out there. A lot of these things you hear from the Obama administration, from the Romney administration, about all those, from just the general press about how to solve, these are rackets. This is for profit, off the kids now. All right, who's left? Okay, so I'm kind of throwing it out there, and let's another show really spend the time to look at the, whether it's, on multiple levels, not that there are a lot of good people in education, yeah, but most of the things you hear today about education is part of, well, we can actually say it out loud now, class war.
Warfare, right.
Because the middle class needs an educational system. Capitalism needs an educated workforce because you want them to work with sophisticated capital, tools, equipment. For the wealth of the nation. You don't want a nation of people, you know, working like in the poor world with little capital, no skills, but that's actually the prescribed future for the majority of Americans on both parties. That's class war.
Right.
You know, and to go back to your original question.
Well, you know, and a good example of trickle-down economics, you can see it in the education system, because the only people that are actually benefiting are the businesses that are... pretty much benefiting off of the school system. For example, the bookstore. When you buy a book that's $200 and the course requires that you have these three other books, that's a lot of money.
We actually try. I mean, we really do in our department. I mean, in economics, we really do our best not to waste. But I'll just say that it's not the bookstore. You know, the college takes a little bit off, you know, to pay for expenses and a little bit. But it's not us. It's the publishing companies.
Right.
If you're talking about textbooks, it's the publishing companies. That's why there's a new edition that's the same every year, so that you can't buy a used copy. You know?
Right.
So, of course, I urge professors to accept any edition. It's a mild inconvenience, but no more. But they've solved that problem, too, by adding all the ancillary material that you have to buy separately and every year again. I mean, it's a racket. I mean, few things around us are honest-to-God business, you know? There's more and more racket. People don't find an opportunity. Just like the humongous multinational corporation, the very powerful, who, you know, they don't need to open new markets or look for new goods. It's just buy a politician. So in the same sense, today, the opportunities for the entrepreneurial spirit in America are in crookery and fraud.
Fraud, right.
That's
right.
The best return, not innovate new. Look, even, hey, for you Apple users, you're beginning to get had, huh? Used to be that Apple really pushed some really good, I'm not an Apple user, but really good products. Now it's like barely an upgrade. And they just make you, restructure the price system and charge you for a phone that's half an inch longer and barely any better. What about that? I bet. Well, never mind. Let's stop geek hate now. But the kids are being, the education system is abysmal on multiple levels. And I'm not talking about in the poor neighborhoods. It is becoming virtually impossible to get your kid, even in the upper middle class, with some exceptions in some states that have managed to preserve better. Florida, of course, is awful. awful among the awful, you know? So we're in really bad shape. We gave up. We tried years of private, public. Private is kind of too expensive on a professor's salary, even two. Cheaper private, you know? We tried it all. I mean, and it's like both of us are PhDs, you know? We value education, me and my wife, and we see our kids left without it. We don't sleep at night. Eventually, we broke down. And we're using it, but it's problematic, the time. Who has the time also, you know? It's
very difficult. Yeah, I was wondering. I mean,
we have a kind of virtual system that since they're bilingual, we're using the French system. So it gives us a structure, and that's recognized. We actually, at Rollins here, we give for anybody with a French baccalaureate or even an American international baccalaureate generally a whole year of credit and all general education. Wow. Frankly, it's because they know it. I mean, my son is 15. He had to catch up on like 2-3 years in most material. Compared to what's required but more importantly, it's the entire model is flawed on multiple levels. And it's not the administration, it's not the union, it's not the teachers. A old Jewish joke saying my dad told me, you know, the fish stinks from the head. So when something stinks, guess what? It's probably at the top where the odor emanates.
Right.
So, again, I'd like to devote time for it, but in some sense, we reach our kids, we start messing with them, and why they are it's difficult for them to be critical of authority as children should, you know, since ancient for the humanities guys out there and gals out there, you know. We know guys, kids grow up, well, the Greeks, so it's so macho, right? So boys grow up, they have to kill their father in the crossroads. That's Sophocles, Oedipus, you know? It's a psychological drama, you know? We overcome our father, we do not do what he says, we become the father.
Father, exactly.
The authority. That's been after many after millennia, it's really being undermined, and in very significant sense, the schooling system, the way it's structured, the high risk testing, or most of these solutions just make it worse. You couldn't design a better way to break down an independent, questioning citizen and turn him into a obedient, hardworking drone, and miserable too. While we're at it.
Now, and before we get off the air here, there's one question I do want to ask you. I was basically tossed into this conversation last night with some of my friends who've actually graduated. Most of the concern that most graduates have, at least lately, or at least the ones that I know that just graduated from this school, they're concerned about these tests to go into graduate school, like the GRE, the LSAT.
Yeah,
now, my perception is that no particular test, it's a litmus test of a person's knowledge. I mean, it can give you a... But it shouldn't be used as a yay or nay to go into a higher education.
Any school, even undergrad, I mean, it's not just one thing, generally, you know. But that's actually an administrative push, again, from the top. You know, it's difficult to measure what you know, to evaluate somebody's portfolio and decide what they did and whether we want to take a risk and accept in graduate or even undergraduate school. I got into Carolina, Chapel Hill, to a large extent like that, because they looked at me and said, this is a weird fellow, let's give him a chance. If he can make it, good. If he flunks... too bad, you know. Interesting fellow, because in some ways I wasn't well prepared compared to my peers, math mostly.
Mm-hmm.
So it's hard, though. It's costly to do that, all right? So isn't it better to have just basic numbers? Like, I was so shocked when I put my kids in school here that they have IQ tests. And it matters if you go into different sections of the curriculum. I remember myself, I'm 46, in like middle school or elementary school, getting IQ tests, and it was already going out of the out as such a bad test. I mean, it has so many biases, so many inconsistencies. It was like we were like, oh, we're sorry, we're giving them. We're in my time, in K-12, it was phased out, right, in Israel, completely. Just don't do it. It's a bad test.
Right, makes sense.
GREs, SATs are better as tests, but good institutions don't look only at that. The problem is today overall is that if you don't have an education, you're screwed for sure.
Right.
If you have an education, you probably are too.
Right.
But maybe you have a chance, slight chance.
Mm-hmm.
We should, I mean, I know we're running out of time here, but we should actually discuss with among all the things that people don't perceive properly, the issue of upward mobility. And if you work hard and have the skill and perseverance, you will make it. Sadly, statistics don't Yeah, it used to be somewhat the case, at least America led in that in the 60s and 70s, the golden age of American capitalism. But now we have negative mobility. In fact, you have a very good chance of dying poorer than your parents, not richer. Well, I know I am.
Yeah, that's true.
How about you?
I don't want to go there.
You stop laughing and start crying. That's
exactly
my thing.
Well, anyway, folks, thank you for listening to our program here. And we'll be back next Friday at 9 o'clock. Of course, there is somebody out there. They're in the cars going to the work. We've just got them really upset. So hopefully they'll, you know, mellow out before they start talking to their bosses. Remember, you do need your job and you do need to pay your taxes. Otherwise, you're going to end up who knows where.
Get angry and do check it out and do. We got to do something about it. Save the world for our children.
Exactly. Have a good day, folks. See you next week.
See ya.
Nothing I've been asking for a loan, a small loan. She told me that I was not economically viable. Yeah, I thank you for 7 years. Excuse me, sir. How's your loan, Erica? Did they give you a loan? He must be economically viable. There's a man with a smile on his face. He looks like a happy customer. That's what an economically viable person looks like.